I have a quote in the front of the CS letter, and I consider that to be a foundational quote of what has happened for me personally in the last 4 years and the spirit of the CS letter. And the quote is from he was a high-ranking leader of the church back in the 50s and 60s. It was J. Reuben Clark. He said, "If we have the truth, it cannot be harmed by investigation. If we have not the truth, it ought to be harmed." To me, that's the spirit of the Mormonism that I grew up in. It was a spirit of to seek truth wherever it is found, not to be afraid of inquiring and questioning.
An ordained minister has decided to give up God for a year.
How the heck do you just up and become atheist after being a pastor?
What I'm most worried about right now is figuring out how I can live openly and honestly.
I am finally free to be me.
I have no idea how to find friends or become a part of a community that's not religious.
What does life look like after church, after religion, after God?
That's it in a nutshell.
This is the Life After God podcast, a conversation on the space between belief and unbelief and beyond, with your host, Ryan Bell.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Life After God podcast. My name is Ryan Bell, and I'm your host. This is episode 40, and it's been a couple weeks since I've spoken to you, and I apologize for that. If you've listened to the podcast regularly or follow me on social media, you'll know I have a new job at Iron Triangle Brewing, which is a ton of fun and I'm learning a lot, but it's been quite time consuming and it's taken me a little while to adjust to this new schedule. So I'm getting my act together though, and I have every intention of bringing you one podcast a week, if not two. And I've got a couple in the can right now that I'm excited to share with you. I recorded with a member of our community named Rachel the other day, and I'm going to put that out in a couple of weeks. I have a recording ready to go with my friend BJ, who lives in New York City, that's been in my hard drive for a while. And so there's a couple of great episodes on the way. I'm reading some great books right now that I'm looking forward to sharing with you, an interview with the author. All of this is in the front of my mind, but I'm also trying to get used to a new job. So I appreciate your patience. It's been a good transition for me, an important transition to allow me to more adequately pay my bills, I guess is the right way to say it. So thanks for all of your support. Especially a huge shout out to those of you that are Patreon supporters. Thank you so much for the investment of your finances of any size. It all helps so much in helping me meet my obligations and be able to take this time to bring you this podcast every week. And we've had a little gap in the beginning of the summer, but I have every intention of bringing you at least one, if not two, podcasts a week going forward. So thanks for your patience and your understanding and your support. It means the world to me. Thank you so much. Today, I have a really great conversation with a new friend of mine, Jeremy Runnels. Some of you that listen to Mormon Stories podcast with John DeLynn have definitely heard of Jeremy. John has done a lot of work with Jeremy, recording conversations with him, supporting him in the transition that you're about to hear about in his life. Jeremy is a native of Southern California, though he lives in Salt Lake City area now. He grew up reaching all the Mormon milestones in his life. He served a mission in New York City. He got married in the San Diego Temple and graduated from BYU. That's Brigham Young University. In 2012, however, Jeremy had an awakening to the LDS Church's truth crisis. In response to Jeremy's awakening, a church educational system director, that's the CES director, church educational system, this man asked Jeremy to write him in 2013 to share his concerns and questions about the LDS historical and doctrinal inconsistencies and problems that Jeremy was having. So he did that. He wrote a long letter, which has now become known as the CES letter, and not too long ago really went viral, not only in the Mormon community, but in the wider public as well. This all came to a head in 2016, just a few months ago in April. The LDS Church attempted to excommunicate Jeremy for apostasy relating to this CES letter. The problem is that there were 3 years of silence from the CES director, and after over a year of consistent refusal from his stake president, Mark Ivins, to answer Jeremy's reasonable questions, Jeremy made the decision during his disciplinary council in April, which he refers to as a kangaroo court, to restore his own power by excommunicating the church from his life rather than allowing the church to excommunicate him, which I thought at the time I read about that in April and then after talking to him now, a really brilliant move on his part to, as he says, reclaim his power and make the decision for himself in his life. I'm going to put all the links to the CES letter and some news stories about Jeremy and his excommunicating the church in the show notes. You can find them there and on the website at lifeaftergod.org. Also, anything else you want to learn about Life After God, you can find it at lifeaftergod.org, as well as our social media pages. We're very active on Facebook, Twitter, and you can follow us at our social media links, all of which can be found at the website. So thanks again for tuning in to this show. I'm excited to jump right into this conversation with Jeremy. I hope you enjoy it. Jeremy, welcome to the Life After God podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Ryan.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure to have you on. And I have been following your story off and on since you wrote the CES letter, which we'll talk about in just a minute and explain for those that don't know what that is. But just over a month ago, man, your life has been a little bit upside down for the last little while. Just over a month ago, you resigned your membership quite dramatically in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So we're going to get into all of that and kind of the how that all blew up. But before we do, take us back to when you were a young person. And I always ask people, tell me about your earliest religious memories. Were they, you know, happy, troublesome, just, you know, if you're anything like me, and I suspect this might be a similarity, you just grew up in religion and in the Mormon church and it was your normal, but maybe not. So tell us how you came to be a Mormon and what those early memories are like for you.
Yeah, sure. I had a really happy childhood. And my upbringing in the LDS church was a net positive. My earliest experience in the church, I think I would point to my baptism. I was baptized by my father when I was 8 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I remember that day, which is not unusual for many Mormons to remember their baptism at 8 years old. So I just remember, you know, it was a happy day coming out of the waters of baptism and feeling different. You know, just the narrative at that time was that I was doing something really special. And, you know, I was doing something that was pleasing, you know, my Heavenly Father. And so that's probably a key religious memory in my childhood. I wasn't converted to the LDS Church back then. I still went to church, you know, on a weekly basis and understood some basics. But I would say that my conversion to Mormonism happened in my teenage years, you know, specifically around 13, 14 years old. That was when I was reading books and really listening to the narrative and the doctrine that was being taught. And so, yeah, my teenage years, it was a net positive experience for me in my childhood. I had great leaders, great young men's presidents and scout masters and bishops. And, you know, there's a sense of community, just great people. I reached all the Mormon milestones. I was a deacon, teacher, priest. Funny thing is, I got my endowment during my senior year in high school, the endowment from the temple, which is where you go to a special ceremony and you receive what is called garments. So I was wearing my garments during my senior year in high school. And I was really looking forward to going on a mission, and I was very, excited about that. I was a full believer. I didn't have any doubts. Church is true. And I had a great missionary experience. I served the mission in New York City. Mm. Most of my mission was either in Manhattan or the South Bronx. I really grew as a person. Learned a lot over there, and I came home from my mission and went to Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. And that's where I met my wife. We got married in the San Diego LDS Temple. And so I was just committed. I was in it. I was in it for the rest of my life. I would have never imagined, leaving the church. It was just not on my radar. So it's an understatement to say that the last 4 years has been really a deviation from the plan, a unexpected turn of events. So
when you look back to like age 14, when you sort of mark your conversion experience, what was it that was most, I guess, life-giving about your experience in the church? What was it that really felt right to you and drew you into that community?
The way that you are taught to decipher or to learn about truth is in Mormonism, is to study it out in your heart and mind and to receive a witness from the Spirit.
Okay.
So I was doing a lot of reading, church approved materials, reading my scriptures during that time, just starting to take my religion more seriously. I think part of that was my, I experienced the first death, in my family for me personally, when my, maternal grandfather died.
Hmm.
So, that brought in the whole death thing. Just wondering, what was the purpose of life and what happens when we die and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so, I think that's what started it. And like I said, Mormons are very big on feelings. If you feel good about something, feel positive, you feel warm inside, it's the Spirit telling you that
that's
it's
your witness, right? When Mormons refer to their witness.
Yeah, exactly. It's the receiving the witness from the Holy Ghost. Exactly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So besides the death of my grandfather, another key event that happened was my father approached, I believe it was the state president at the time, to see about me getting a hearing blessing from what we call general authorities, which are the leaders based in Salt Lake. And what happened was we got a green light to have one general authority give me a hearing blessing.
And what does that mean exactly?
It means that, like in Mormonism, we believe that we have the true priesthood, the rightful, legitimate authority from God to act in His name or on His behalf.
Right.
We don't. Like nobody else has it. We kind of joke that 12-year-old boys have more power and more authority than the Pope does. So,
right.
So we take priesthood real seriously. So, so basically, it's the belief that through the priesthood power, you can, make people whole. Heal the blind, heal the sick, make the deaf hear again, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, I had a lot of faith at that time. I had a lot of faith that if I would just get this hearing blessing, that my hearing would be restored. Hmm. At this time, I was wearing hearing aids in both ears. I was born hearing, and when I was about 3 years old, I was diagnosed with hearing loss. I had what is called progressive hearing loss, mm-hmm. which means that year after year, my hearing would get progressively worse. So, so my hearing was getting worse over the years. And, you know, as a teenager, it's a problem because, you know, social, being social with your friends is a big part of being a teenager. And right. so I was noticing that it was affecting me, and it was just something that was on my mind. So we had a meeting with this general authority to give me a hearing blessing. This was in Arcadia, California. I grew up in California, so we just went over there and mm-hmm. met with this general authority. And he gave me a hearing blessing, and in that hearing blessing, he promised that my ears would be unstopped and that my hearing would be restored. And, I shit you not, like, I expected to put my hearing aids away and that I was going to hear with, you know, that day, that week.
That was your faith that would happen, right?
Oh, yeah. Like I said, I took this seriously. I mean, I had faith, and I really believed that it was going to happen. And unfortunately, the hours turned into, you know, days turned into a week, weeks turned into a month, and months turned into years. And not only did it not happen, but my hearing continued to progressively get worse. But despite this, I still held on to the faith and believed that someday it was going to be restored. It's on God's timetable. He knows
right.
More than I do. And I just have to trust that it's going to all go according to plan. Well, so I guess I can talk about that later. But basically, in that meeting, when I got my hearing blessing, we were sitting in a lobby waiting for the general authority to come out of another meeting. And when he came out, he stood at the doorway and, you know, kind of waved at us to come over to him. And as I came over to him and shook his hand, I felt this feeling that was just really crazy. And I interpreted that feeling to be the Holy Ghost telling me that, you know, this man is important and he has the priesthood of God, and that, you know, with that train of logic, the church is true and Joseph Smith was a true prophet and the Book of Mormon is true. You know, like, you just connect these dots, this train, because if this is true, then that's true, and then that's true, and so on and so forth. So that experience was extremely powerful in my conversion experience, and I would say that it was a foundation that I based my belief and testimony of Mormonism for, you know, from moving forward from that day.
Even though nothing happened, it was still interpreted by you in your faith framework as something powerful because you felt something. Is that right?
That's right. And it's as I mentioned, I've read all this stuff. I read about, you know, the first vision and how the Book of Mormon came to be and so on and so forth. That was the intellectual side. And then this meeting and shaking his hand and feeling this feeling that I interpreted as the witness of the Holy Ghost, that was the spiritual, emotional side. And so it kind of locked in all of these different elements that ultimately formed my Mormon testimony.
Wow. Did you ever have a chance to ask this man or someone else later, what their explanation it was that in all of these years your hearing hasn't improved? In fact, it's gotten a little bit worse.
I haven't. And by the way, the man that did this, very nice guy, no problem with him. I actually ran into him again maybe 2-3 years later after I got my hearing blessing when I went up to Salt Lake for a general conference. This was in the Tabernacle before they moved it over to the conference center. But I after general conference was over, I went up to him and shook his hand, and, you know, he asked me how I was doing. And but I never, you know, we didn't go into that. We just, you know, just didn't talk about it. yeah. My understanding right now, he's actually the legal counsel for the LDS Church. He's basically the church's top lawyer or attorney.
Huh.
Yeah, and he's also what they call emeritus, which means that he was released as a general authority.
Okay.
But yeah, I never talked to him about it, but I did meet with him, you know, once again, 2 or 3 years after the hearing blessing in Salt Lake. But it was a very short, brief, hey, how you doing? Good to see you. See you later type thing.
Right. So you do your mission in Manhattan and in the Bronx in during college, right? Is that a segment out of college or after?
It was before college.
Oh, before.
So I was
okay.
19 when I took off, and I came back when I was 21.
And so what was that like for you? Like, I mean, were you what most of us imagine, you know, with a black tie and a bicycle and going around door to door, knocking on doors?
What I imagined going into it and what actually happened is night and day.
Hmm.
It was an extremely humbling experience. I grew up in Orange County, California, and so I had a good childhood. It was somewhat of a bubble.
Right.
And to go from that and being dropped into the South Bronx.
Oh, I just have this mental picture, but it's like, yeah, I got you.
it was really a humbling experience. It just kind of kicked my ass and said, hey, you're not as important as you think you are. Just a little snot kid.
That's an important lesson in life, isn't it?
Yeah. And so, but just the poverty and I mean, going to some people's homes and seeing that they had like an open can of soup in the refrigerator and that's it.
Wow.
You know, just the unbelievable poverty in the Bronx. And then, you know, like taking a step higher with the whole mission experience, including Manhattan, where I've seen, you know, great wealth. I've been into really amazing, luxurious apartments and so forth.
Right.
And New York is just a melting pot. It's really true that there's just people from all over the world and all right. kinds of cultures. And so just being exposed to all that was really a humbling, eye-opening experience. I came home just a different person. Just my paradigm of life completely changed.
How did your view of your faith change? How did it affect your, not just your beliefs, but your feeling about being a Mormon?
I still believed. I didn't have doubts, but it changed my, I would say before my mission, I was a little bit more, I wasn't cocky, but I had this kind of smugness. You know, I had to, look, I'm special because, you know, I was preordained in the pre-existence because to be born into the one truth, the one true religion. And, you know, I have something special that other people don't. And so whether or not it's, Mormons intend this, it does make them kind of smug in their beliefs and makes them think that they're to one degree or another better than other people, that they have something that other people don't. I think it put a dent on that. It made me realize that even though I'm fortunate to know the truth, I'm not so great. I'm not. Like, it took away that smugness, I think. Mm-hmm. It just humbled me a lot, seeing the diversity. And I think it was probably the start of putting things on my shelf, but I didn't realize what a shelf was or that I had things on my shelf. It was more of a subconscious starting, like the water was starting to boil, so to speak, that would later surface, I guess. But, yeah, it definitely changed me. It definitely changed how I saw Mormonism and how I saw myself, but it wasn't like, you know, I didn't even know that I, like, it, you know, like, one of those things, like, there's things that you don't know that you don't know. It's like one of those things. I didn't know that there was a shelf and things were happening. It was just more of a subconscious type thing, I think.
So today you're no longer a part of the LDS Church. I definitely want to have you tell that story, but maybe you could start by saying when maybe you first had that oh shit moment when you thought, uh-oh, this doesn't make any sense.
I would say that in 2012, I Church is True, and I was just continuing on my Mormon path that
it's so recent.
It's about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So I came across an article, and it was called Mormons Besieged by the Modern Age. And in that article, they talked about the, at the time, the LDS Church historian, his name is Marlon K. Jensen. And he did a Q&A at Utah State University. And one of the questions that was asked was what the church was doing about the drove of individuals that were leaving the church over Google. In other words, people searching for Google and finding out information about the church's history and doctrinal inconsistencies and so forth. A lot of people are leaving.
So the church was keeping these things down and quiet, that people couldn't access them until they could have access to the internet themselves and just look for it themselves?
Oh, yeah. There's a saying that what the printing press was to the Catholic Church, the internet is to the Mormon Church. So what the internet has done to Mormonism is just unbelievable, and we're still in the middle of history right now. There's the internet back in, the early days in 2000, but what has happened in the last 7-8 years with social media has really taken it to a whole new level and has really accelerated the exodus, the decline, the number of members leaving the church. And Elder Marlon K. Jensen, the church historian, in answer to that question in the Q&A, he said, "We are experiencing an apostasy not seen since Kirtland." And Kirtland was a city where the early saints and Joseph Smith were in, and they had a crisis back in 1838 with the Kirtland Banking Society. It was basically a banking fraud, and it was really bad. A lot of apostles took off and so forth. Right. And so it was a really bad time for the Mormon church, for Mormonism back then. So to compare to that, in my mind, it blew my mind. Because I just didn't understand why people were leaving over history. I just thought history was nice and clean because I trusted and believed what the church's narrative and what they were telling me about the history.
Right. And what are the rough demographics of people leaving the church?
Millennials, teenagers, 20-somethings, 30-somethings, and some 40-somethings. I'm noticing more and more baby boomers are awakening, so to speak, because there's children and grandchildren are bringing, just children mainly are bringing, telling them that they're leaving the church and they're leaving because of X, Y, and Z. So it's mostly the millennials and some of the Generation X.
And is it a sharp decline? Is it like a steep line going down, like the church is losing members?
It appears that it's a sharp. We don't know how sharp. We don't have exact numbers because the LDS Church doesn't release resignation numbers. so we kind of have to. They're happy to tell you every single other number,
sure,
but they don't tell you the resignation. But we can kind of see, we're seeing other evidences of this happening. So one of the examples was Elder Mark, Elder Jensen, when he made that statement that we're experiencing an apostasy not seen since Kirtland,
right?
Which is pretty bad. that. But then, you know, not too long after that, the church made a new policy change where they lowered the missionary ages. So it used to be that you had to wait until you're 19 years old for males to leave on a mission. They lowered that to 18. And it used to be for 21 years old for females, and they lowered that to 19. And so that was another indication that, you know, they're going after the younger generation, try to get them before, you know, they can go off to college and have that 1 year before they go on a mission and prevent them from Googling, so to speak. So, and, you know, just seeing the rise, I mean, we're seeing more and more people joining forums and ex-Mormon forums and Facebook groups online. And it just, but also another thing that's showing that things are getting bad is it used to be unheard of to hear stuff like doubt your doubts general conference and, you know, stay in the boat and, just all this stuff where they're telling people to just hold on and don't look at anti-Mormon stuff. And they're doing this in general conference, which is really surprising. We're seeing firesides where some apostles are giving tantrums. One of them is Elder Holland. He had a tantrum in, I believe it was in Tucson, Arizona, where he said, you know, I'm really furious that people are leaving the church and just saying, you know, weird stuff like, you know, taffy pole and like how they're painting apostates, so to speak, like so-called apostates or people that leave the church, how they're trying to paint them as, you know, people to avoid or not listen to, or it's just a really interesting time that we're experiencing now with the rhetoric and the you know, what they're saying in general conference and firesides. And I was also told by some other people that who are still active in the church that it seems like every Sunday there's always something about doubt. Hmm. You know, somebody goes up to share their testimony about how their loved one or family member or friend left the church and how they feel about that. And there's a lesson here and there about, you know, doubting your doubts. And so it's a really interesting time right now for Mormonism.
So what happened to you then in 2012 when you first started feeling those doubts for yourself? What was the impetus for that, or what was the moment that you can look back to and say that's where it all started?
I would say that, like, when I read that article and I found out that it was, you know, people are leaving over history, my first question was, well, why are they leaving over history? What's wrong with history? So I pulled up Google. Uh-huh. And I typed in, one of the article mentioned Joseph Smith's polygamy. So I typed in something about Joseph Smith's polygamy and read about his polygamy. And I came across something called polyandry. And polyandry is where, you know, in this case, Joseph Smith married other living men's wives. Hmm. And that just fucking blew my mind.
Yeah.
Like, that just... Like, I just thought it was just Joseph Smith and Emma. I mean, I knew that I knew about polygamy from Brigham Young on, and I understood, you know, we have the practice polygamy in Utah and all that stuff. But to me, it was just Joseph Smith and Emma. That was the narrative,
right?
That the church correlated narrative that I was taught growing up. So just so to find out that not only Joseph Smith was a polygamist, but that he was involved in polyandry just blew my mind.
And what was the church's response to that? I mean, do they have an official, like, did they just say, no, that's not true, that didn't happen, or?
They released an essay about 2 years later, in 2014, I believe it was, called The Kirtland and Nauvoo Polygamy. And, yeah, they talked about that. Basically, what some apologists try to do is they try to claim that it was a dynastic sealing. In other words, it was just spiritual marriages, that there wasn't, you know, really any sexual you know, relationship or anything like that.
Yeah.
But the historical record shows otherwise. There was, it was, I mean, with one person, for example, Sylvia Sessions, a lot of apologists and historians agree that she did indeed have a child with Joseph Smith. And she, it was a polyandrous marriage. She was married to another Latter-day Saint.
Wow.
So it's really nasty down there with all the polyandry and all the child brides. He married 14-year-olds, and it was not acceptable or normal back then, even though some apologists have tried to claim that. The church's essay, which is funny, they admit these things. They admit that Joseph Smith married a 14-year-old.
Right.
But in the essay, they said, they instead of saying that the girl was 14, they say that she was just a few months shy of her 15th birthday.
As if that makes it better.
Yeah, exactly. As 15 is not so bad as 14.
Right. Phew. Boy, that was close. Oh, my goodness. So you start looking into that, and, you know, your mind's blown, right, that Joseph Smith, this holy, and not just a holy man, but a man divinely inspired by God, and not just divinely inspired by God, but the divinely inspired by God to inaugurate and lead the one true church. And then, so does it just kind of cascade from there, from the polygamy and polyandry, and then it's just like dominoes falling, or what happened next?
Well, I mean, with Joseph Smith, I didn't see him as a perfect man, and most Mormons don't see him as a perfect man. They see him as a human being.
Yeah.
That did make mistakes. But at the same time, we also do stuff like we sing praise to the man in church, which is a hymn. And there's scripture that talks about that he did more work, save Jesus only, for the salvation of man. So we kind of put him up there, but we also try to say, well, he's not a god. He was just a really good man. So that was the narrative. That was the story that I, you know, sure, had in mind with Joseph Smith. So when I came across all this polyandry stuff and him marrying 14-year-olds and other teen brides, it really put a dent on how I saw him. And that just got worse and worse over the years, and significantly worse as I went deeper and deeper in the rabbit hole of polygamy and all this other stuff. It's really a rabbit hole. It really gets crazier and crazier and crazier. I know historians that have been studying Mormonism for, you know, 20 years, and they still find out, you know, stuff that blows their mind.
Huh.
It's really a fascinating subject. So yeah, it was, like you mentioned, a dominoes falling type thing. After I looked into the polygamy and polyandry stuff, I went over to the Book of Abraham. And the Book of Abraham blew my mind. One of the key things in Mormonism is the claim, Joseph Smith's claim, that he translated. Because, you know, the story with the Book of Mormon, for example, is that Joseph Smith took gold plates and that he translated what was on the gold plates into what we now know as the Book of Mormon. So it was, the Book of Abraham really is an insight to the claim of translation. And it's a really fascinating insight into Joseph Smith's modus operandi.
Is that also written by Joseph Smith?
Yeah, like he claimed that he translated that. It was a little translation from Egypt, from papyrus.
Oh, right, right.
And, you know, the Egyptian stuff. And the evidence is so damning that the church has taught for most of its history that it was a little translation from papyrus, and we have the facsimiles. Facsimiles are basically copies of pictures of Egyptian, you know, graphics and stuff. And Joseph Smith actually translated, you know, this and this and that and this in these graphics.
Right.
And those are put in the scripture, the Book of Abraham. So the evidence is so damning and so bad against Joseph Smith's claims and the LDS Church's claims that the church in this Book of Abraham essay that it released within the last couple of years has put forth a what they call a catalyst theory, which is Joseph Smith. It wasn't a literal translation like we taught, guys. You know, perhaps Joseph Smith just touched the papyrus and he received a revelation, and that revelation is what became the Book of Abraham. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to get away from the physical and going into the metaphysical so right. that they can get away with it. And it's really bizarre.
So it's like moving the goalpost all the time. It's not what you thought it
exactly.
was.
Exactly. And a lot of that is happening.
Yeah. So then what? I mean, you're experiencing all of this like major cognitive dissonance, right? Like your whole house of cards that you've been taught and believed and even went out on mission to, you know, proclaim to the world, it's just crumbling right before your eyes.
Yeah. I remember that moment staring into the abyss. And what I mean by that was after looking into this stuff, but not looking into it deep enough to conclude that the church is not true,
right?
But looking at it enough to know, holy shit, something's wrong here. And I'm not sure exactly what it is, but something is just wrong here. And it's looking at that abyss and making that decision on whether or not you're going to jump into it and go for it and research and just hope that you're going to turn out okay on the other side.
Yeah.
And it's an extremely, it's an extremely scary thing to look into. You just don't know what's going to happen when you make that step, that leap of faith, ironically.
Yeah.
And so when I stared at that abyss, it scared me. So I turned around and put everything on the shelf and stopped researching for probably about a month or two.
Oh, wow.
I was just scared to look at it.
Huh.
So during that month or two, I just couldn't, the cognitive dissonance was heavy. Like,
yeah.
It just gnawed at me. It just ate me inside. I just, I lost sleep. It was just heavy. So after about a month or two of that, I said, you know, this is not sustainable. I can't keep doing this for the rest of my life. So I made the decision to just jump into the abyss. And I started doing research. I ordered books on Amazon and just research. And I've been doing that ever since. And, you know, it really is a rabbit hole that is just completely mind-blowing.
Is that where the CES letter ended up coming from?
So this is 2012, starting about February 2012. And then I just researched from then on. Where the CES letter came from was in the summer of 2012, I basically came out to my family, to my grandfather and my dad and so, you know, my brothers and so on, my sister and all my family members. And my grandfather was disturbed by my loss of faith. And so he basically, bless his heart, he tried to rescue me. And so part of that rescue was to introduce his CES director friend into the equation. CES stands for Church Educational System.
Okay.
So it's basically the side of the church that does, you know, that teaches members about church history and doctrine and so on and so forth. And so he was friends with the church, with the CES director. And so my grandfather asked me if I would be open to talking with the CES director in hopes of resolving my concerns and doubts. This was in April of 2013, so about a year after my, I hate to use the term crisis of faith because I think it sounds disempowering. So yeah. I like to say awakening to the church's truth crisis.
Okay. Yeah, it's the church's crisis more than yours.
Right, exactly. So it was about a year after my awakening to the church's truth crisis. And during that year, most of I researched a bunch of different stuff online and offline. And part of that research included what I call the pet theories of unofficial Mormon apologists. In other words, they're just regular guys that are sharing their opinions and pet theories, which are not backed officially by the church.
Okay.
So it's no more official than the crazy old guy that you see in church every Sunday that everybody rolls their eyes to.
Right.
And so I researched what they had to say, and these are guys like Fair Mormon and, you know, just guys like that, organizations like that. Mm-hmm. So after, I was just really frustrated and flabbergasted with what they were saying, and they were not resolving my concerns. They were not answering the questions. So to have the CES director email me and say, hey, I'm a friend of your grandfather. I want to help. Lay out your concerns and questions on the table, and let's see what we can do. To be able to have that was a breath of fresh air. It was my opportunity to get official answers from the church, mm-hmm. not unofficial pet theories from unofficial Mormon apologists, but official answers from an official representative of the LDS Church. So I was really excited about that opportunity, and I wanted to take full advantage of this opportunity. I didn't want to just give them one or two of my concerns while I had 20, 30 other concerns. And part of my background as a deaf individual, writing has always come naturally to me. Mm-hmm. I consider it my language. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can write something real quick. I mean, to some people, 80 pages, 85 pages, which was the CES letter. It's not difficult for me. I mean, I can do that relatively quickly. So I decided to just go for it and list all my concerns and questions in that document for the CES director. And so I attached it, I saved it as a PDF, and I attached that PDF to an email and sent it over to the CES director. He actually read it and got back to me and said that it was a very well-written document, almost like a thesis. And that that the concerns that I shared in the CES letter, some of those concerns were also concerns that the brethren had. And to those that are outside of Mormonism, brethren sounds really culty. But in Mormonism, when we say the brethren, we're referring to, you know, the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve, which Mormons consider prophets, seers, and revelators. So it was really eye-opening for him to share that, to share that these are concerns that the brethren have as well. So yeah, he said that he would get back to me, and unfortunately, he never got back to me. That was 3 years ago. Never heard back from him again.
Ever again?
Never again.
Wow. And so even after you've like gone through all this media exposure and everything, he's just never. And this is still your grandfather's friend.
Yeah, he was my grandfather's friend. And my grandfather at the time, he was in his 80s. I was not interested in him reading the CES letter or getting involved in it. Right. I just wanted him to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he just leave him out of this. So, but yeah, he never got back to me. There were some Mormon apologists that made the claim, well, Jeremy's far gone. Nothing the CES director will say. We'll get him back. You know, get him back in.
Well, where's their faith
now?
That's not
the point.
I mean, I said, where is their faith now? You know that you're so far gone, even God can't bring you back.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my response to that was, that's not the CES director said that he would get back to me.
Right.
And so it's you know. The decent thing to do is to get back to me like you said he would.
Right.
If he wasn't going to get back to me or he changed his mind, then the decent thing to do was to say, hey, I know I told you that I was going to get back to you, but I changed my decision. But none of that ever happened. He just completely went off the radar. And the other thing is that this document went viral on the internet. So it was no longer just about Jeremy Runnels. It's about all these other thousands of people that also share the same concerns and questions.
And how did that happen? How did the document end up like being so public?
So in the course of writing this document, before I sent it to the CES director, I shared it with in closed Facebook group and on Reddit, ex-Mormon subreddit. I shared it with them to get feedback and to make sure that things were tight, the problems and doctrinal stuff and as well as grammar, because I just didn't want to waste his time. I just wanted a tight document so that I could get a tight answer, so to speak.
Yeah.
So the people that were giving me, the friends and individuals that were giving me feedback, apparently they liked it enough to share it with their family and friends, and then it just started the viral effect.
Okay.
From there. Contrary to what a lot of people think, I didn't just, register a domain name and put it up there. And the website came much later after it had already gone viral. But yeah, that's how it started. My position has been from a defense posture. So when where the website and the domain came from was a few months later, in the summer of 2013, Fair Mormon, that unofficial Mormon apologetic group, for some reason they decided that it would be a good idea to, attack me personally. They made some outrageous bullshit claims that they just had to respond to. So that's where the website came from.
Okay.
And also the church was starting to release its essays, which was offering an official response to some of the problems. So I felt that from an ethical point of view that I had to include these new essay updates and the links to these essays in the CES letter itself. So I figured it was a good idea to have the website not just for defense to respond to these critics and Mormon apologists, but to kind of create an official source for the document so that it included these essay updates, and it was a convenience for people to access the updated CES letter.
Okay. And then when did it start getting ugly for you, where you were now threatened with excommunication? I mean, it's from all the reports that I've read online and stuff, it sounds to me like your grandfather connects you to this, elder in the church who's going to help you with your problems, your questions and your doubts. And the next thing is, so you trust that process and you write this all up. And the next thing you know, you're being threatened with excommunication. Is that kind of like what happened?
So my grandfather and the CS director, that stuff happened in April 2013. And then the apologist started attacking me in the summer 2013. And then my website came out around that time or in the beginning of 2014.
Yeah.
And in the spring of 2014, I had an interview with Mormon Stories, John DeLand.
Oh, yes. And he's been on the show.
Yeah, he's awesome. I love that guy. So my interview, I think, is where it took the CES letter to a whole new level. And I did that for various reasons, but yeah, I did my interview with him, that's on YouTube. And, that was in the spring of 2014. Well, I think that's where the turning, what happened was after the interview, it took things up to a whole new level in terms of traffic, a bunch more visitors, like the viral effect, went to, fourth gear. In the fall of 2014, which is a few months later, I received a call from my state president, and he wanted me to come in, into his church office. So my first meeting with him was on October 19th, and I'd never met the guy before. And so that meeting was mainly just getting to know each other and to talk about how he knew about me. And he hadn't read the CES letters, so I committed him to reading it. And then we met about 2 weeks later and had another meeting. This was all documented, audio recorded. Okay. I have everything on a single page. It's that CES letter ces.org /resign. So again, cesletter.org/resign. I have audio recordings and everything is 100% documented. But yeah, that in the fall of 2014, so I had two meetings with the state president. And the second meeting was where things got really interesting. And I could tell that he was getting ready to take me to the church court. But I challenged him on that. I brought up issues that the church admitted in its new church essays. So I think it really, I think it really surprised him. I don't think he was expecting me to challenge him the way that I did. So, to my surprise, I hadn't heard from him again for about a year and a half. And so that brings us over to 2016. In the beginning of 2016, is when I heard back from him again after a year and a half of radio silence.
For a year and a half, really nothing happened. Then you're just waiting.
Yeah, from that point of view, I haven't heard from him. I mean, a lot of things happened in terms for the CES letter and it becoming more viral and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's just really weird how I didn't hear anything from him. And to go from that to basically a phone call saying, I want you to come in. And that phone call, I asked him why he wanted me to come in, thinking that he was going to answer my questions from our last meeting a year and a half earlier. But instead of it being, hey, I finally got the answer that I told you I was going to get you, it was, we want you to come in so that we can discuss your membership in the church.
Wow.
So, it was just that's just my experience with the LDS Church. Like, the CS director, hey, give me your questions and we'll get them answered. Okay, here you go. And then radio silence. My second meeting with the state president in the fall of 2014, you know, this question, that question, okay, we'll get him answered. Well, you know, let's take care of this. Radio silence. So I have no doubt in my mind that church leaders in Salt Lake were involved in this, and they were applying pressure on the state president this year, 2016, to basically, you know, get me out of the church. So a lot of back and forth with the state president this year. Again, that's documented on that webpage that I just mentioned. Again, nobody has to take my word for anything. It's all audio recorded and emails and email screenshots. The consistent thing with the state president has been that he just refused to answer my reasonable questions. And my reasonable questions were, I had three questions. One of them was, what mistakes or errors in the CES letter or on my website are there so that I can publicly correct them?
Yeah.
He refused to answer that one time. The second one was, if there are no mistakes or errors in the CES letter, why am I punished for seeking and sharing the truth?
Yeah.
And he refused to answer that one. And the third one was, what questions have I asked, am I being punished for? And he refused to answer that. I've asked those questions probably about 20, 25 times over the, you know, during the whole time. And not a single question was answered. So even with this consistent refusal to answer those questions, he tried to hold a court on me on Valentine's Day. And so they call these things a court of love because the idea is they're doing this out of love so that so that you can be called to repentance and see the errors of your ways.
Right.
Well, I kept asking him, what are the errors of my ways? What, you know, like, help me.
Yes.
If there are mistakes or errors, I will publicly correct them.
Right.
And I have an errors page on my website showing past mistakes that I've made in the CES letter where I corrected them. And so what's another few mistakes? A few more mistakes. Just show me them and I will publicly correct them. And despite this, he still tried to hold a court on me on Valentine's Day. I had a press conference with John DeLynn, again with Mormon Stories, where we at the time talked about what has happened up to that point. And so that press conference was held on Wednesday evening, you know, before Valentine's Day. The next morning, I got an email 5 o'clock in the morning from the state president saying that the court, that the Valentine's Day Court of Love has been postponed. So I thought that was, pretty funny. So it was postponed to May 20th. And, you know, down the road, that was canceled as well. But, you know, it was just, the whole thing was just a mess from the state president's actions. Like, he just made one fumble, one mistake after another. I was just really disturbed how I was treated. During this time, my grandfather, my beloved grandfather, who I was very close to, he was also, by the way, he's also the grandfather that was involved in getting the CES director involved. He was in hospice care. So it was basically a fuck you from the state president. We don't care that your grandfather's in hospice care. We're still moving forward and kicking you out of our VIP heaven.
Oh my goodness.
And so, yeah, they just didn't care about that. So, and he actually really was in hospice care, and he actually died on March 8th. And
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, it was just time to go. But anyway, so and then it was just very unchristlike how they did things and how they treated me. After later down the road in April. I got a letter from the state president announcing that they were holding a court on me on April 17th. And in that letter were conditions, you know, like who I can have as witnesses. And one of the other conditions was that I cannot have an ASL interpreter present in the meeting.
What?
Yeah. So... And so, so it's just added insult. Like, not only did the church promise that my hearing would be restored at 14 years old, and that hearing didn't happen. Like, it did the restoration. It did happen. My hearing was restored, but it was restored through science.
Right.
I got what is called cochlear implants, which is basically the only technology right now that functionally restores hearing or it restores a human sense. And so that's what I mean. Even with cochlear implants, I hear pretty good with cochlear implants, but even with cochlear implants, I still use closed captions on TVs and at the movie theater. And I use interpreters especially at important events.
Right.
And I consider this a very important event. I mean, I was going to be put into a room with basically 15 guys that were very hostile toward me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I thought totally. It was a reasonable request to have an ASL interpreter there. And you know, I lost my hearing about 6 months before that, because I developed an infection. So I really was half deaf. I was missing my other cochlear implant. So it really wasn't a reasonable request as a half deaf person with a cochlear implant to have an ASL interpreter present.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you're being like brought up on some kind of charges, you need to understand what those charges are.
Exactly. And I didn't know what the fuck they were going to charge me with. I didn't know if they were going to go the character assassination route and accuse me of child molestation. I didn't know what they were going to do.
Right.
Like, I needed to be on my A game here.
So what happened then?
So I got that letter about a week, you know, a week and 2 days before the court date on the 17th. And, so what I did is I decided, you know, this is not right. So I basically put on Facebook, on social media, a graphic or a meme, basically this, letting the world know that the state president was denying me an ASL interpreter. And that really pissed off a lot of people.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it went viral. So a lot of outrage. I mean, even the news media were picking up on it. And their question was, is it really true that he's denying you an interpreter? Like, they just couldn't believe it. They thought they were, they wanted to make a story out of that alone. So what happened was, after that, the court date came up. So I went up over to the church. There was a crowd there to support me. The media was there. And so I had an interpreter. So I decided that I was going to take him in with me into the church building anyway. So I took him in with me. And when I went up to the state president, he said that my interpreter was not welcome, but that basically he changed his mind and that he now had an interpreter. So I was really pissed off at how just the hassle that he put me through and, you know, how he blindsided me with that. It just pissed me off.
Yeah.
So I just, so because he provided, because they were providing interpreter, I let it go and told my interpreter to, you know, just go back outside. So after that, the state president took me into to a door, and he tried to open that door, and it was locked. So somebody inside unlocked the door and opened it. And inside were basically, you know, that what we call the high council, which is a group of 12 men. And then there was his counselors, his first counselor and the second counselor. So I walked in and shook hands with everyone and introduced myself, and they introduced themselves. So that process took about 5 minutes. The church's interpreter was not present in that room. So and the state president wasn't either. So he was out there trying to grab the interpreter. So it took 5 minutes for the interpreter to come in. So the message that I got from that was, it was basically his backup plan. It was not, you know what I mean? He wasn't going out of his way to accommodate me. The vibe that I got was, oh shit, he brought his interpreter and now I got to go to plan B and actually wow. grab the interpreter in the other room.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so that interpreter came in, and so we started with a meeting, and, you know, that's all recorded. It's on that page, that website that I just mentioned. Again, nobody has to take my word on anything. They can see for themselves how I was treated and how the church treats those who question and doubt, or who have questions and who have doubts. It was just extremely cold in there. I mean, I was going in there with questions. I had pages of questions. I went in there expecting dialogue, but instead of dialogue, it was, you know, 15 minutes. He presents his case and his quote unquote evidences against me. And then 45 minutes, my side where I say what I want to say. And then that's it. There was no, I mean, I tried over and over, like, will you answer this? Are you going to, I asked him, you know, are you going to answer any questions this evening? And he said no. It was just, I mean, to say that this is a court is laughable. And it really was, in every sense of a word, a kangaroo court. And that's exactly what I called it.
Yeah.
I saw that. So he presented his case, and then I started presenting mine and talking about my experience and how I sought official answers from official church channels, and 3 years of silence from the CES director, and a year and a half of silence from the state president himself. And when I saw the kangaroo court for what it is, and they just were not going to answer any questions, I said what I needed to say. And then at the end of it, I basically said, you know, I said to their face, this is a kangaroo court. I'm done with this court. I am excommunicating the LDS Church. I am excommunicating you, President. And I'm excommunicating this kangaroo court from my life.
Wow.
And then I handed my resignation and walked out of the room.
Before they had a chance to issue their, like, judgment or whatever.
Yeah, the idea is that the leaders of a church have what is called a church handbook, and it's basically church protocol and how they should conduct meetings. He did not conduct it the way that it should have been conducted, but what I knew that he had 15 minutes and he gave me 45 minutes. He was very specific that I had 45 minutes. And so I knew that I needed to if I was going to resign, it had to happen before I was done. And they had an opportunity to, you know, dismiss me and deliberate and so forth. So yeah, I fired them before they could fire me.
What was their reaction to that?
He was surprised.
Right.
If I was a state president personally, I would be relieved, because from his point of view, he was actually going to kick me out of Mormon VIP heaven,
right?
Which is a pretty big thing. So I would imagine he was relieved that I took power in my hands and he didn't have to have that on. I'm just saying this from a point of view that I would hope that he's somewhere down there is honest and has a conscience. I think that deep down he knew that something's wrong if he can't answer my questions, and he was willing to go all the way.
Yeah.
That's why I say that I'm pretty convinced that the church leadership in Salt Lake was involved in this, and he just had to obey his prophecies and revelators, and that's basically what happened.
Yeah, it essentially sounds like damage control. You know, like your thing was getting too much attention. Your letter, all of your questions, it just wasn't going to go away. And so they either could answer your questions, and they knew that they didn't have adequate answers probably, or they could just, you know, excommunicate you and know that within a year or two, from their perspective at least, it would all blow over.
Yeah, what they were hoping to do was they were hoping to put a scarlet letter, I'm not sure if that is the appropriate label for this situation, but they're basically hoping to put an X, like Tyler Glenn's trash video, X on my face. Basically, this point to, like, to have them to point to you in front of the members and say, this guy right here, he's an apostate. We excommunicated him. Don't read what he has to say. It's anti-Mormon.
And also, don't you dare do this, because this will be your fate as well.
Yeah. And so that's what they were hoping to do. But what I did is I turned the tables on them.
Right.
And I resigned. So, and not only that, everything is documented. But the way that these church courts work is they want it done in secret.
Yes.
And it usually is done in secret. And they don't tell members or the community exactly what the charges are or what you've been excommunicated. So what they do is they leave it to the imagination of Mormons in the community as to why you've been excommunicated. Was it, you know, pornography, adultery, you know, all these hideous sins.
And everybody's imagination is going wild with that.
Exactly. And so they wanted that for my case. They wanted to be able to say, oh, he was excommunicated, and then just leave it at that without revealing exactly what the charges were.
And how do you... I'm sorry, continue. Yeah.
I just didn't want that. So I wanted to make it crystal clear, and I wanted every word heard so that everybody can see for themselves how it went down.
That's amazing. I mean, I'm sure that took a lot of courage, and I mean, your family is probably sort of upside down about it. Has that been a hardship for you as well, kind of coping with your family's reaction to all of this?
Yeah, it's been hard. But, you know, again, this has been a drawn out process. So it wasn't like it happened overnight. I mean, the CES letter, for example, started in April 2013. So it was about 3 years.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it was still hard. And, but I just had to do what was right for myself. The funny thing is, like, I grew up in a Mormonism where you do what is right while letting the consequence follow.
Yeah.
And ironically, what I did that day was the most Mormon thing I've ever done. In terms of my Mormonism, the Mormonism where you just do the right thing, it's going to be hard and consequence will follow, but just do it.
I felt the same way about my Seventh-day Adventism. I felt when I was, you know, stepping away from Seventh-day Adventism that I was being the most Seventh-day Adventist in a way that I had ever been, you know, standing for the truth, even though others were sort of advocating this status quo and not settling for the faith of others, but really looking for my own truth, you know, the truth as I understood it from my own study and research. And their counsel was just to, as you said, be quiet, you know, don't ask so many questions. It'll all become obvious in due time. And I was like, no, that's the papalism, you know, papacy kind of thing that you're constantly saying is bad, that we need to avoid that kind of papal hierarchy that tells you what to believe. We're supposed to be like the good Bereans, you know, in Corinthians that, you know, researched for themselves and found out if it was true or not.
Yeah.
What about those Bereans?
Yeah, I completely relate to that. It's funny hearing that from somebody from a different faith tradition, but yeah, I completely relate to that.
How do you identify yourself now? Are you still like a person of like some kind of spirituality or a different type of faith, or are you an atheist? How do you think of yourself?
So when Mormonism collapsed for me a few years ago, I went the deist route. Well, in the beginning, it was Christian. But then when I decided to use the same set of tools that I used to examine Mormonism, I applied it over to Christianity and the Bible, looking at the foundations of Christianity, and I just didn't like what I found down there. So I went from Mormon to Christian to deist.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a deist for a couple of years. I think it took me a while. I think I was a deist for as long as I was, because my focus has been mainly on Mormonism and CES letter stuff. The CES letter thing still kind of kept me in Mormonism and researching it and responding to critics and apologists and so forth.
Right.
But, you know, as I got more time and I started looking at things, and where I'm at now is I consider myself an agnostic atheist.
Uh-huh.
Agnostic is I don't know for sure whether or not there's a God, but atheist is I don't believe in the gods that we know of. I'm skeptical of that.
Right.
What brought me there was, you know, I've watched a lot of YouTube videos, you know, with Christopher Hitchens and Dawkins and Sam Harris, and you know, the debates. I've read their books and Age of Reason, not just that, just the research and the intellectual side of things. It was also realizing that the deist thing was based on a faith-based paradigm or a faith-based model of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that, you know, like Carl Sagan said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Right.
And it just became logical that I needed to switch over to an evidence-based paradigm or evidence-based model of the world.
I completely relate to that. People often ask me, you know, when you left the Seventh-day Adventist Church, why didn't you become like a liberal Christian or Unitarian? Unitarian Universalist is probably a bad example, because you can be an agnostic atheist or whatever and be a Unitarian Universalist. But why didn't, you know, they would say, why didn't you just become like Episcopalian or a liberal Christian? And like you, I just, the bottom just kept, you know, I didn't find the bottom of the well. You know, I was digging down for the bottom, like where is the solid ground? And pretty easily decided that Seventh-day Adventism was not on solid ground. But I thought there'll be some kind of Christian solid ground, and there wasn't. And then I thought, like you, I thought, well, there's kind of some spiritual connection. All the world's religions are sort of barking up the same tree, probably, right? You know, and so maybe there's kind of a vague spirituality that I could say, oh, there's the solid ground. But that sort of fell away. And I just came down to, you know, a kind of naturalism, you know, where I just thought it makes the most sense to me that this, that we have, that we can understand with our senses and that we're continuing to learn about, by the way, like not that we've figured it all out, obviously, but the tools of our five senses, amplified by science and technology, are the best way to interrogate the world, not through, as you said, a faith-based system, but an evidence-based system. So, I mean, my pattern of sort of thinking about these things follows yours quite closely.
Yeah, and I agree with that 100%. So three things before I forget. So one of them is, for me, science is personal. My experience with my deafness, I went to religion. I went to my faith to solve the problem, to restore my hearing, and they failed. And it was science that came in and fixed it.
Right.
So basically, you know, I'd like to share a message about my Lord and Savior, science and Google and reason, and you know what I mean?
The trinity of science and reason and Google.
And yeah, so it's personal. Like, it's not just my hearing, but like, it really has changed. It made my life easier in terms of like email, for example. Like back then when I wasn't as good as I am on the phone now, email was a godsend to be able to communicate with the world without the need of the telephone.
Wow.
So it's just all these advances, and just look at how humanity has advanced the last 400 years since we started saying, I don't know. Let's find the answer. Let's test. Came up with the scientific method. So extremely powerful stuff. The other thing is, you asked about why I didn't go into, you know, another Christian faith, or another Christian tradition. Mormonism is different in the sense that they claim to be restorationists.
Right.
And it was really drilled in our heads in the church that we are not those Christians. We are the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. The Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ came to the prophet Joseph to restore the real Christianity, the real gospel, in these latter days. And it ironically, it gave us the tools to basically deconstruct other religions. And, you know, as a missionary in New York City, I was basically in the Salt Lake City version of Jehovah's Witnesses.
Right.
They have their, you know, their headquarters in Brooklyn. So I came across a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses on my mission. One funny story is we were going tracting. We had an appointment, and we went up to the door of our appointment, and just as we were about to knock, a group of Jehovah's Witnesses missionaries came out of the elevator and came to our door.
You're like, funny that you should knock here.
So we're all like, it became like a game of who stands down.
And you could be there so for
we're
a
all
long
just standing
time.
Standing there waiting for the damn guy to answer his door. And so it was really awkward. And the reason why this happened is because it was an ASL mission. Like, it was a mission focused on deaf individuals. Yeah. So it was a very specific targeted thing. You know, like, I went straight to that door because there's a deaf individual behind that door. And those Jehovah's Witnesses missionaries were also deaf missionaries as well. So that's why we were standing in front of that door. It was just a really, but going back to the point I was making, I mean, I had my own copy of the New World Translation, and I had it marked down, and I knew about the failed prophecies, and I knew how to approach them, and you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, yeah. It gave me the tool to deconstruct another religion, and obviously, I would never apply that tool to my own. Yeah, so I didn't go to another faith, another Christian religion, because it was already false to me. And just coming out of Mormonism and just seeing how, like, what an unbelievable fraud. Like, it just so ridiculously disprovable.
Yeah.
It just left the unbelievable bad taste in my mouth with all of the religions. In terms of spirituality, like, I just have a hard time with this idea that there's a God that intervenes into human affairs. Mm-hmm. You know, that this God is going to answer my prayer to bless my greasy Little Caesar's pizza, or, you know, answer the prayer of, like, the help Provo Jennifer find her Jetta car keys.
Right.
While ignoring the pleas of refugees and, you know, poor souls in Africa and North Korea and all the children that are stuck in sex trafficking. Like, there's just so much evil in this world. Like, it's an insult that God's going to help, you know, Provo Jennifer find her Jetta car keys, but annoy these people that
right.
need help. They need their prayers answered.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, it is kind of an interesting, when the scales fall from your eyes, you see the error of what's nearest to you, which in your case was Mormonism, in my case was Seventh-day Adventism. But as your eyes begin to adjust to the new light, you begin to see not just Mormonism for what it is, but all of it, you know, and even non-religious things. I mean, my views have changed slightly about all kinds of things because my way of looking at the world in general has changed and opened. So,
absolutely. And I would add to that that the real funny thing is I found myself to be more Christ-like.
Interesting.
Leaving Mormonism. Like, the big thing about Christ is charity, like loving people, like really loving them and not judging them.
Yeah.
And I found that I was most loving and non-judgmental now. I just accept people. I realize that they're doing the best they can with the resources they have, and they're doing the best they can with their models of the world. And I've never been in their shoes, and I just love them. I'm not judgmental toward them. So it's a really interesting paradox that I've never been, again, I've never been so Mormon and so Christ-like than I am now. It's just really funny.
That's really an interesting observation. Well, I've taken about as much time as I should from your evening. Just in one last question, do you feel a kind of compulsion now to, maybe compulsion's too strong of a word, but a desire to sort of, so to say, save other Mormons from this? Do you have a desire to reach out to people that are Mormon and try to labor with them that it's a fraud, as you said?
I did during my angry stage.
Yeah.
We all have
one of those.
Yeah. The five stages of grief, and there's yes. the angry stage.
Yes. Yeah.
I did, but I've gotten to a point now where I realize that it's not my place to change people's lives like that. Ultimately, people change their own lives. I just speak my truth and my experience. And if that affects and changes their lives, they allow that. It's not, they allow it because they've given themselves permission to do that. They've made that leap of faith into the abyss.
Right.
And it wasn't because of me breathing down their neck or putting them in their spot.
You must have dozens of people, if not hundreds of people, reaching out to you to say, me too, me too, me too.
Oh, yeah. I get emails often. I think the reason why the CS letter has resonated with the hundreds of thousands of people that it has is that my questions and my concerns and my story is also their questions and concerns and their story. Like, my story is not really that unique.
Right.
It's just that it's a similar story to what others have gone through. And I think, you know, I have a talent for writing, and I think I've been able to put into words in a way that resonates with people and speaks to their experience and their frustrations and their desire for truth and so on.
Well, I'm sure it's an inspiration, you know, even if, you know, what I've found is that even when people don't necessarily follow my path or your path, which is, as you said so perfectly, I think my goal is not to make people follow my path, but it does inspire people to have courage to ask questions. And so I'm always encouraging people, you know, you may not like the conclusions I've come to, but please don't forbid yourself from asking the questions that you have and seeking answers in your own time and in your own way. And if we come to different answers and different conclusions, that's fine. But just, you know, don't foreclose on that process, you know. And I'm encouraged because I think that message really resonates with people. Like, yeah, people should, if they have a question about something, you should be able to ask it. And unlike your experience, people ought to provide their best answers, and then people can decide for themselves, you know, what they ultimately believe.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a quote in the front of the CES letter, and I consider that to be a foundational quote of what has happened for me personally in the last 4 years and the spirit of the CES letter. And the quote is from he was a high-ranking leader of the church. He was a counselor in the first presidency back in the 50s and 60s. But it was J. Reuben Clark. He said, if we have the truth, it cannot be harmed by investigation. If we have not the truth, it ought to be harmed.
Well, that's such a great quote. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's, to me, that's the spirit of the Mormonism that I grew up with, grew up in. It was a spirit of to seek truth wherever it is found, not to be afraid of inquiring and questioning.
Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for taking this time to share your story. It's you know, another unfortunate tale of you know, the church, in this case, the Mormon Church, you know, acting badly. But it's also a story of courage on your part. And, you know, the way that, you know, things can work out okay. Like, you're doing well, you're happy, you're fulfilled, you're finding new purpose in life. And I think that helps people as well. So thank you just for being so open about it all. And I'll put all the links to the CES letter website where they can download the CES letter and listen to any of the recordings that you referred to and read some of the news stories and so forth. So I'll link all that in the show notes. So if you're listening, you want to check more out about Jeremy and his story, you can do that. I'll link to some news articles as well. And a special shout out to our mutual friend, John DeLynn, for all the work that he's doing as well. And it was through John that I heard about you, and so it's a great pleasure to spend this 90 minutes or so talking with you tonight.
Absolutely. And likewise, I really appreciate this, and it's been a great honor. I really admire your work, and thank you so much for having me.
You bet. We'll talk again soon.
All right. Take care.
Jeremy Runnels, ladies and gentlemen. I'm so happy that you tuned in for this conversation. Listening to it two or three times myself, I'm just, again, impressed by Jeremy's integrity and honesty. And I love the way that he patiently followed the sort of the intellectual and emotional and spiritual process that felt right to him. You know, he had questions, and so he asked them and waited for a response, and then asked again for some feedback, didn't get it, went to the next level, was threatened by the church, accepted those threats and confronted his accusers. You know, at no point in the story that I can detect, at least, did he lash out or act badly. I mean, it was just, he was patient. And I think that patience in allowing your questions to come to the surface, ask them with integrity, kindly confront the people in authority, and ask for, you know, reasonable response. This is a good model, I think, for anyone who is in what we might call a crisis of faith or a crisis of intellectual honesty, or spiritual discovery. So, and as I said to Jeremy, and as we said to each other on the show, the expectation is not that we all end up in the same place with the same beliefs or conclusions about the world and life and religion, but that we all take the time to ask our questions in a way that allows us to sleep at night, that allows us to make the most of our lives and love well in the world and be healthy individuals. And I have no doubt that Jeremy is doing well. I can just tell by listening to him talk and talking with him that he's in a better place. And I'm grateful for that. And so if you're listening to this and you're on the fence and you're not sure what to do, I hope that you'll follow Jeremy's example and maybe, you know, put pen to paper, sit down in front of your computer and write out your questions and spend some time with it. Let it sit for a few days. Come back to it. Write some more about your questions. And then, you know, seek out the people in your life who you think might have some insight about those questions. And they might have reading material that they would recommend for you. And just start diving into it and see where it leads you. And take it at your own speed and your own pace as you can handle it. And don't let anybody shame you for not asking your questions quicker or handling them faster or asking them at all, any of that stuff. This is your journey. This is your story. And I think Jeremy's example really illustrates how that can work. So thanks again for tuning in. Huge thanks to Jeremy for spending that time with me. Thanks to John DeLynn for informing me about Jeremy and his story and for covering it so well on Mormon Stories. A quick shout out to Mormon Stories. If you haven't heard the podcast, it's an immensely popular show that John does, and I hope you'll check it out. I'll put a link to his show as well in the show notes below. So that's about it for us this week. Thanks again for tuning in. You can learn more about Life After God at our website, lifeaftergod.org. We'll see you back here next week with a new episode of the show. Until then, my name is Ryan Bell, and this has been Life After God.